This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. American drivers buy one-ninth of the world's crude oil. Every second, the United States burns 10,000 gallons of gasoline. Journalist Lisa Marganelli says that makes us elephants in the global oil economy. Marganelli started thinking about oil in 2001. She was in Iraq to report on Saddam Hussein's birthday. Before long, she was hooked on, obsessed with what she calls the culture of oil. Marganelli traveled around the world looking into the culture of oil, from her local gas station to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to an Iranian oil platform and beyond. On the program today, we're going to hear what she learned, or some of what she learned. Lisa Marganelli, the author of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from the Pump to the Pipeline, is our guest. And listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Lisa Marganelli is currently an Irvine Fellow at the New America Foundation. She has written for several publications, including the San Francisco Chronicle, Wired, and Discover. Her honors include an Excellence in Journalism Award from the Northern California Society of Professional Journalists. Oil on the Brain, Adventures from the Pump to the Pipeline is published by Nantelis, an imprint of Doubleday. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Lisa Marganelli, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine.
Like you have a storm there.
We do. We have a blizzard underway, but we're doing just fine. Lights are on. It's warm.
That's great.
Yeah. Iraq 2001, you were there, as I mentioned, to report on Saddam Hussein's birthday, and you say oil seeped into every aspect of life there. How so?
Well, you know, oil was the thing that gave Saddam his power, and oil was also the thing that gave Saddam the desire to control all of Iraq, was that he could centralize all those revenues, all those oil revenues could go to essentially to one person or one group of people, the Ba'ath Party. So it was part of his way of ruling and who he was. And essentially everyone in Iraq was waiting around somehow to get some of the money from the oil. The hotel that I was staying in was an old Sheraton, which had obviously been built during the time when people were coming to invest in Iraq. And there were a whole bunch of oil smugglers hanging out in the hotel. They were involved with taking oil from Iraq and putting it on tanker ships and taking it out to other places in the Middle East and selling it.
Hmm. And then a little more than a year later, you were in Prudhoe Bay.
Actually, later on that month, I ended up in Prudhoe
Bay.
Really?
Okay.
And so that was, I got two oil stories that were tangentially about oil in the same month. And then I started thinking about oil a lot.
And it was when you were in Prudhoe Bay, though, and you saw a demonstration of a method for cleaning up oil spills. And it seems that's when you were really hooked on the story.
Really hooked, yes. Well, after I had the two experiences with the oil stories, I decided to go search out oil stories. And one of the things I wondered about was how scientists were working on cleaning up oil spills. So about a year later, I ended up in Prudhoe Bay again with a couple of engineers, a petroleum engineer and sort of an ice engineer and some people from the Minerals Management Service who were working on essentially lighting oil spills on fire. They were dropping sandwich baggies of napalm on top of oil spills that were floating in icy water and then lighting them on fire and seeing how long it took them to burn.
That must have been quite a sight.
It really was, you know, because crude oil is this mixture of everything from very light, kind of gassy hydrocarbon molecules all the way to big, thick, heavy ones. And so you get this sort of symphonic burn You know, when you light gasoline on fire, it goes kind of woof, mm-hmm. and it's gone. But when you have so many different kinds of molecules, you get this kind of, you get like a little burn at first, and then it roars way up above your head, and it kind of dances around, and then it slowly starts to die back down. It's quite amazing, and I was just entranced. And talking to the petroleum chemist who compared oil to fine wine, and he said, you know, the compound is different from every well is different, every kind of oil is different, and I was intrigued both by the performance of the oil and by this man's obsession with oil and his ability to articulate it to me in a way that I'd never heard before.
Yeah. How do refineries deal with the differences then in crude?
Well, they actually sample the crude before it comes in to the harbor. Usually it comes in tankers. And then they adjust their processing sort of path to account for that crude. But one of the big issues right now is that light sweet crude, which is sort of easy to refine crude oil without much sulfur in it or without too many salts, is becoming more and more scarce in the market and more expensive. And so there's more and more of the heavy, sort of a sludgier, more sulfurous, more salty crude is available, and that might come from sometimes from Saudi Arabia or sometimes from Venezuela or from other places. That oil needs different sorts of refinery setups. It needs special vacuum towers, for example, that use steam to crack apart the big molecules. So refineries in the U.S. are having to update by adding in the ability to process those other crudes.
Hmm. You met so many interesting people who seemed so open with you. Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. Of course, there are lots of people who I didn't talk to who obviously weren't so open to me. So you've got kind of a selective sample in the book, you know, anybody who would talk to me. But, yeah, people who work in the oil industry tend to be there because they love it, and they love some aspect of the complexity of it. And once I got in and started talking to people and showed them that I was interested in what they had to say, people were very open.
Oh. One of the people that you introduce us to very early in the book is the man behind the counter, the owner of a gas station where mm-hmm. you presumably buy gasoline there in Oakland, California.
Yes, actually it was a station in San Francisco that I used to always go to because it seemed a little bit friendly to me, although I hadn't really sorted out why it seemed friendly. In the end, I realized it was largely because of the where the ramps were to get off the road and into the gas station. It wasn't anything
user-friendly.
It wasn't anything that big. And it also was because they had signs up saying that if you were old or disabled, they would pump your gas for you on Tuesdays,
how nice.
Which was very nice. So I went there, and I ended up meeting the owner and spending time talking to him about the difficulty of selling gas. And his profit margin per gallon of gas is quite low, often 5 cents or less per gallon. And the hassles of owning a gas station are just enormous, everything from hostile customers to sneaky employees to the difficulty of competing with a gas station when you're competing for customers both on the retail level and you're competing for cheap gas on the wholesale level.
Yeah.
It's a tough job.
Yeah, and the customers, we can be quite unpleasant, if not downright bad. What are some of the things the folks behind the counter have to put up with?
Well, obviously there is a fair amount of crime and holdups that happen mm-hmm. in gas stations, so that's one of the things. Another thing is there's a fair amount of driving off without paying, especially in parts of the country where people don't pay before they pump. Another thing is that many of the people who run gas stations are from India or Pakistan or Bangladesh, partly because certain families have gotten involved in the business. And some of them have to deal with a tremendous amount of hostility from customers after 9/11. I think 100 clerks were assaulted in 7-Elevens for looking Middle Eastern. And so the National Association of Convenience Stores issued a whole list of tips to make your counter staff more safer, which involved things like placing flags near the register and taking up a collection for 9/11 workers.
Mm. One of the reasons I go to the gas station that I go to is I like the people behind the counter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm apparently not alone.
No, people have very deep feelings for their clerks. And many of the clerks really get to know their customers. You know, people are kind of harried and frazzled when they come in to buy gas, and the clerks may give them a kind word, and it means a lot to them. Mm-hmm. Or they may just give them napkins because they see they've got the kids and things are getting out of hand.
So if they're making 5 cents, if the gas station, if the owner of the gas station is making 5 cents or less a gallon, where are they making their money?
They're making their money on the snacks, the water, the sodas. They call, in a gas station, they call the cooler the vault. And that sort of suggests that that's where the money is in the gas station, is the vault. They get it by selling impulse buys. Sunglasses have 100% markup. Apparently, gas stations don't actually sell many sunglasses. I've always wondered about this. Why are gas stations always selling sunglasses? They don't actually sell that many of them, but they make so much a profit on each pair that it's worth having those sunglasses on the counter.
Hmm. You know, this is always something that I've wondered about. You know, when you pull in to the gas station, the gasoline has been in the tanks at the station for some period of time, but yet the price can go up and down while that stuff is just sitting down below.
Mm-hmm.
Why does the price vacillate like that when the stuff is there on the premises?
Well, I'll work back just a little bit.
Okay.
If you own a gas station, you need to be selling your gas at the price that it will cost you to replace it. So you essentially have to sell today's gas at tomorrow's price.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So because if you're selling your gas for much less than you're going to pay to replace it, then you're going to start losing money. And staying afloat as a gas station is just a very sort of it's a tricky dance that you have to do. You have to be sure that you're not selling the gas for less than you paid for it, and that you'll be able to replace that gas with new gas the next day.
So you need a Ouija board.
Basically.
Yeah.
You need some crazy spreadsheets, and you need to be able to really guess ahead, and you need good relationships with your suppliers. The other reason that gas prices fluctuate so much now is that American drivers use so much gas that we're really at the edge of our infrastructure's capabilities. Some of our pipelines are running in the high 90% of capacity. And that means that any little blip anywhere in the system, at a refinery, in a pipeline, you're closer to the inland waterways where there are barges backed up waiting to go through the locks because the locks need to be replaced, apparently. All of these things add up to little tiny blips that send the price up and down.
Mm, very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Lisa Marganelli, author of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from the Pump to the Pipeline. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, let's take a look at some infrastructure. One of the places you visited doing the research, the reporting for this book, a refinery in California, and they can afford a certain amount of blips, but they have to have 82% of their days to be really good days.
Yes.
What's a really good day?
Well, one thing to realize about the oil industry is that its job is not only making money, but also getting us fuel. And so in a very reliable stream through all sorts of ups and downs and difficulties of tankers and countries and everything. So the way that they do that is they manage risk. And so they're very, very good at managing risk. And one of the things that British Petroleum decided was that their refineries needed kind of a number or a criteria for establishing what was a good day. For example, they met their processing targets. They had no injuries and no environmental errors, and they had a couple of other kinds of criteria that they had to meet. And then they set a goal for the whole facility, saying that 82% of their days had to be really good days. And the day that I showed up, unfortunately for them and probably fortunately for me, was not a really good day. There was actually a problem in the processing. One of the generators shut down while I was there, and so alarms went off and people had to evacuate the area, and I got to see all of that.
So that would be a
really bad day.
Really bad day.
Yeah.
A downright really bad day.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Lisa Marganelli, our guest this afternoon. Let's take a call now. A listener in Long Grove on line 4. Hi.
Hi. This is very interesting, what you're discussing. Could you tell me, are we in the process of building at least one or two new refineries, and where would they be, and how soon would they be working?
Well, to my knowledge, there's only one refinery that has applied for permits to build in the United States, and that's in Arizona, and it's still not clear whether that's being built. I may not have the latest information, but as of a month or so ago, that's where things stood.
Who applied for that?
I'm not sure what the name of the company in Arizona.
Uh-huh.
But mostly the way that refineries grow now, and we haven't really had a new refinery built in the U.S. since the early 70s, mostly the way that they grow now is called refinery creep, and that is that a refinery develops the ability to process more fuel. And since the mid-90s, I think refineries in the U.S. have increased their capacity by about 28% just through creep inside the walls of the refinery.
All right. Well, it takes a long time to build one, doesn't it?
It does. It takes 10 years or so, possibly more. I mean, it's hard to imagine that it would be very easy to get the permits for a new refinery just because people don't really want them near them. But the other problem with refineries is that they have always been on coastal land because that way it's easier for them to get tanker shipments. And coastal land now is so valuable for real estate developers and for homes that it's hard to get, it's hard to get your hands on that land in a place that would be suitable for building a refinery.
It would seem as if we would get together with Mexico and do a joint effort on something like this. It would seem, I don't know, practical to me. How do you feel about that?
I haven't really thought about getting together with Mexico. I do know that there have been discussions that if China were to really throw itself into refining and were to be refining more than enough fuel to meet their needs, then they would be shipping that to the U.S. I know in California we get refined gasoline from places as far away as Nova Scotia, Trinidad, and Finland, I think. So there is kind of a global refining industry, and they will throw the right specification of gasoline into a tanker and send it off to wherever the high bidders are. The U.S. gets more and more of its fuel refined overseas now.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana. Line 1, hi.
Hi. I am very interested in this subject. I had a question about refineries. I've heard this argument about the reason that we don't build more refineries, especially here in the U.S., is not I've heard the argument on the one hand that it's due to excessive regulation. If we just loosened all the regulations, then there'd be more refineries built. But on the other hand, I've heard an entirely different argument that says there's a group of petroleum geologists that have formed an association called the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, ASPO, and they are claiming that we are nearing our oil peak, the peak of world oil production, probably within the next 10 years or so. And if they are correct, or even close to correct, wouldn't it be an economic reason that oil companies wouldn't build more refineries if there weren't going to be, you know, increasing supplies, but actually decreasing supplies of oil?
Well, I think, let's see, there's so many questions in there, and
yeah.
They're all really good. I think one thing is that if you had talked to people about refining in 1998, they would have said, any oil company would have said, oh, refineries are just a headache, we're not making any money on them. Refineries have not traditionally been a big profit center for the oil industry. They make more of their money taking the oil out of the ground and a little bit more selling it to gas stations. But refineries used to be very, very hard to make a profit at. So what happened was in the U.S., many refineries were shut down because we really had too much refinery capacity. And also, during the 80s, we reduced the amount of gasoline that we used in our cars because our cars became so much more efficient. As the 90s drew to a close, we started using more and more gasoline, and obviously that has continued up, you know, through the last 7 years. So now refining is much tighter, now the capacity is much tighter. As far as the environmental regulations keeping people from building refineries, they're just so expensive that no one's really had the urge to build a refinery, as far as I can tell. It may be that some of the environmental regulations are preventing the building of refineries, but you have to ask who would pay the cost of building refineries without environmental regulations. A lot of times that gets borne by the people who live close to the refineries. So I think that's one question. Now then your second question about peak oil. I've read the arguments of the people on peak oil, and we definitely are reaching the peak of oil production in countries outside of OPEC that don't have large reserves, like the U.S., many countries around the world, including Mexico, which has been a major supplier for us. Norway is another one. Great Britain's another one. And those countries, as the concentration of reserves goes more towards the large holders of reserves, like Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Russia, and Venezuela, the politics of oil are going to change, and they're already changing. I don't know that we're actually going to peak out on the amount of oil that's produced. My personal feeling is that we should become far more efficient and use a lot less oil in our economy. And I think it would stimulate productivity and insulate us against high prices, as well as preventing a lot of pollution.
Yeah, very interesting. There's actually points of view in the peak oil debate. One is that it's going to happen in the next 10 years, and then there's another one that's they're called the late toppers, and topping being the oil topping point. And they say it's going to happen in 20, 25, maybe 30 years. And, it seems crucial to me that we ought to know the answer to that question, because then we will need to. It would have great import upon our energy consumption and the need for conservation and so forth. And I was just curious about, you know, what you thought. I've been reading various books about this. You know, some saying late, some saying early, and so forth. And it's hard for a lay person not in the industry or not connected to the industry to know which one is correct. So. Is there a debate in the oil industry now that about this? Are they speaking about this in public, private, about this peak oil business?
People talk about it. They're very interested in it. They already know, however, they know that the balance of power is shifting, and I think that's a bigger issue.
Wow.
And that's what's behind all the exploration and investment in African oil resources. You know, it's also somewhat behind Russia's behavior, because they realized that they had access or had huge reserves. My personal sense is that it's not going to be lack of oil in the ground that's going to change things as much as the inability to get it out, either for political reasons or mm-hmm. just for logistical reasons, the difficulty of building pipelines or shipping it. I also think that, you know, the U.S. is so close to the capacity of our domestic infrastructure that we really should start to conserve oil now, because we need more space in that infrastructure, and we know that we're going to have a larger population over the next 20 or 30 years, and we're very, very close to the limits of it now.
And we have emerging world markets.
Yes, and we are in competition with other countries like China and India for those reserves. But interestingly enough, things are a little bit different than in 1973 when we saw ourselves as possibly in competition with other buyers of oil. Now, China actually buys 1 million barrels of oil a day, turns it into products, and ships those products to the U.S. So we actually get an extra 1 million barrels a day kind of embedded in Chinese products, which is really complicates the issue.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call. Very good questions this afternoon. Before I go to the next listener who's waiting for us, let me ask you this question. How good is the U.S. at oil diplomacy?
Well, one of the things that I've heard said about in the Middle East is that the U.S. is playing poker and people in the Middle East are playing chess. And I think that that's sort of the case. I think that we really need to revise our oil, what we think of as oil diplomacy, and really look at oil states in a more open way.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Listener on line 2 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Ms. Marganelli, can you talk at all about the price for gas that Americans pay at the pump versus the price that's paid in other countries, and how those compare, whether they seem fair, what those prices reflect, and all that sort of discussion?
Okay. Maybe I'll just start in a little bit, and then I'll stop and check in with you and see if this is the direction you're looking for. We pay fairly low taxes in the U.S., about 56 cents a gallon, I think, in taxes, although it really varies by state. They're relatively low. We also pay a lot of other money for gas through our general taxes. And one of the numbers that I've seen is somewhere around $30 billion a year in taxes going towards subsidies for the oil industry and things like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and other elements of subsidizing or paying for gas in kind of indirect ways. One of the things that many oil-dependent states do is they give people in their states, in their countries, cheaper gas as kind of a reward for being part of the petrostate and not getting a dividend check in the mail every year. So in Venezuela, for example, gasoline is 15 cents a gallon. In Nigeria, it's $1.48. In Iraq, it's 11 cents. In Iran, it's 34 cents a gallon. And that gives you an idea of what happens in those states. People use more and more gasoline, and it actually starts to choke off the revenue sources for the state itself, because if people domestically are using all this oil, then they can't be shipping it overseas and getting $60 a barrel for it. What's interesting is that Norway also has been for a long time an oil exporter, and there they charge $6 a gallon for people to use gasoline. So you can see that how much you charge for gasoline or the kind of taxes you put on it really influence the way people use it and the way they view it.
Last year when gas prices went up to $3 a gallon, essentially, mm-hmm. across the United States, was there a comparable increase around the world?
Yes, there was.
And what was what was driving that?
Well, it's because we're all buying from the same pool, essentially. When gas prices went up, in the fall, you mean in the fall of 2006 or the fall of 2005 after Hurricane Katrina?
I guess I don't recall.
Let's talk about Katrina. With Katrina, a huge amount of U.S. oil production was wiped out in the Gulf, and a lot of our refineries were also wiped out because about, I think, 25% of the country's refining capacity is in the Gulf, so a lot of those were down. So what happened was we were drawing oil from Europe, or gasoline was being processed in Europe and brought over in tankers to the U.S. because prices were so high here. And what happens basically is that because you can throw oil on a tanker in Europe when there's a shortage in the U.S., the price kind of evens out around the world, although obviously taxes are going to influence how much you pay from place to place.
And what drove the prices in the fall of 2006?
I know that there was a big run-up in prices in the spring of 2006, and that had to do with a couple of things. One is that every spring, U.S. Gas stations have to switch from selling the winter blend of gasoline to selling the summer blend of gasoline. And the reason, for pollution reasons. So whenever that changeover happens, there's some sort of stress in the system, and there's likely to be little supply blips, and that kind of drives the price up around the country. I think that that coincided also with very, very high crude oil prices, and that was when, in the spring of 2006, was when prices went up to being around, they were well above $3 in California, but California's prices are higher than the rest of the country. Oddly enough, this last fall, 2006 fall, prices were falling because there was a slight oversupply and there was more gasoline available.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Mattoon on line 4. Hi.
Yes, Lisa, I'd like to have you verify two statistics. One statistic I got out of the Wall Street Journal in June of 2004, it said that we import 58% of our oil. Then in January of this year, 2007, I got out of the Christian Science Monitor that now the U.S. imports 65% of its oil. Can this be true?
Oh, I would place the current imports at closer to 60%. I would imagine that the 65% number was from a single month that we might have been importing 65%.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. What is your thoughts? What does the general person know about this oil? It seems like I live in Mattoon, and you can tell these people about this, and they don't have the slightest idea. I think about 90% of the people in Mattoon don't worry about it. They have other things to worry about.
Well, I think that's the case for all of us. We all have other things to worry about, and we don't really worry about gas until it's either really expensive or it's suddenly not there as it was in 1973 when it actually wasn't at our gas pumps. And that's a big problem for us because we're so dependent. Our economy is so dependent upon this oil.
Yeah.
James Schlesinger, who was the first Secretary of Energy in the U.S., said that we went from complacency to panic, and that those were our sort of two modes of dealing with oil, and it's true. I think we probably need to have a third mode, which is sort of quiet concern and actually constructively doing something.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Lisa.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, oil on the brain is a great primer. I mean, and there are wonderful stories in this book, and you've done us a great service, Lisa.
Oh, thank you. I had so much fun doing it.
Yeah. Well, let's keep taking calls. We've got a lot of folks here would like to talk with you. Next, we go to Spring Bay, line 3. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Well, it was about a year and a half ago, Celeste, that I listened to you interview James Howard Kunstler, and I've become a peak oil guy since then,
mm-hmm.
Probably reading Energy Bulletin and post-oil living on a daily basis.
Wow.
So you've created a Frankenfurter here. But a couple of different things. Kenneth DeFays, who is a retired professor from Princeton and part of ASPO, has stated that, in his opinion, we peaked in global production in December of 2005. And I think it was about 91.5 million barrels globally for the day, on a daily thing. And we haven't really gone past that. So we haven't increased production now in over a year. One of my observations is, it seems to me, the more I read about this, every place you find oil, you find misery. Look at the Nigeria Delta. Look at Iraq, mm-hmm. which has the second largest reserve of oil globally. Look what's going on in Russia. It's just one example after another of misery and oil. And I agree with the caller that just from Mattoon, nobody seems to be paying attention. And I guess I would ask this question. Today they're discussing what to do in Iraq in the House of Representatives, and I don't hear any discussion of really the strategic reason we're there, which is oil. And if we don't talk about oil as a reason for being in this war, how can we start to discuss what we should be doing there? And I'll hang up and continue to listen to your conversation. Thank you.
Well, care to comment?
Well, I guess I have three thoughts on that. One is, yes, oil and misery do seem to go together, but of course they do not in Norway. And I think that frequently the sort of system that is set up, the kind of state that evolves around petroleum reserves and around a petroleum export, is quite a miserable one to live in. And that's something that we all need to start reckoning with. Life in an oil importer is very easy, and life as an oil exporter is quite difficult, just because the state doesn't really serve the needs of the people. It serves the needs of either the elites who are getting the oil money, or somehow is built just around the oil. So that's one problem. I think the U.S. Has never really grappled with exactly what they're doing in Iraq and how much of it relates to oil. Obviously, quite a bit of it does. One thing that I find interesting about the problems in Iraq is that we really focus on when we talk about the current problems in Iraq, we talk about problems between insurgents and American troops and also militia, and we talk about it as having this religious component between the Shias and the Sunnis. And I was talking with a Fulbright scholar named Bilal Wahab, who is from Iraqi Kurdistan and has studied the trade in illegal oil in Iraq. And he said that in his opinion, what underlies this is the ability to smuggle oil out of the country for huge amounts of money. And that then translates into weapons. And in his opinion, if you could stop the smuggling, you'd stop a lot of the fighting. And so from his point of view, it wasn't so much the religious differences, but it's the fact that the oil provides such ready access to money and to weapons. And it provides such a prize for groups struggling for control of the country.
Mm. But to get control of an underground economy like that.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be easy,
yeah.
But it might be easier. It might be important to do it at the same time that one attempts to deal with long-standing religious differences.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you. This kind of dovetails into the last caller and an earlier caller about the price of gas that we pay at the pump, and there's a hidden cost that I wonder if you deal with in your book, that if you've calculated what the cost at the pump price would be if we factored in the very significant portion, probably a majority of the portion of the Pentagon budget that goes to ensuring our access to foreign oil.
Yes, the number I've seen is around $5 a gallon. Those estimates, though, are always very those estimates range from around probably 50 cents a gallon up to $5 a gallon, and there's probably some that are smaller. I have not personally gone through and figured out which charges seem sensible and which do not. But we definitely are paying through the Pentagon budget. We are paying for our access to oil. There's no question about it.
You know, I would certainly contend that the real reason we are not only invaded Iraq but remain there has everything to do with wanting to have a control over the oil in Iraq. And while they said it was only going to cost $40 billion for the Iraq War, we've already gone way over that, and a lot of people are estimating that by the time it's all said and done, we'll probably have topped $1 trillion just for this adventure, and that doesn't count all the other money that we're using to ensure our access to oil and other fields.
Well, and it also doesn't count the cost of rising oil prices over the past 5 years, which between oil and natural gas and energy prices rising. In the U.S., apparently, American consumers have shelled out an extra $1 trillion over the past 5 years for rising energy prices. That's enormous.
And ExxonMobil has had record profits.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you.
Let's take one more call before we run out of time. A listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hello. I'm glad one of the previous callers brought up James Howard Kunstler. His book, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century, titled The Long Emergency, is a must reading for anybody that's interested in this question. Now, what we are up against here is the second law of thermodynamics, which in today's lingo, let's say it takes more energy to produce an energy-giving product than the energy that you get out of the product itself. And the previous caller to him, the consensus is we're past Hubbard's peak. And then we have the problem of middle-class values. How do we get the soccer moms to give up their SUVs? And I'll let you go at that. Thank you very much.
Okay, Lisa.
Well, I think it is true. We all need to start making changes. But part of making those changes is recognizing that we have a problem. And I think that we have sort of multiple layers of problems, ranging from greenhouse gases to filling up fuel infrastructure to the inability to control prices or politics overseas to the Iraq War to, you can just go on and on and on to the absolute misery that's going on in Nigeria around the oil-producing areas and a growing problem in Chad. And all of these involve energy, and all of them require action, both on the individual level and on a kind of larger political level. And I think that we need to start demanding better policies and better answers from our politicians. We can't just say, oh, the oil companies are cheating us. We actually need to go out there, and we need to really change the amount of fuel that we use. And we need to change. We have about maybe 100 years of government policies that have really supported using more and more fuel. And what we really need to do is change those policies to support using less and less, to manage our demand and really cut it down and become much more efficient.
Mm. And read Oil on the Brain.
Thank you.
Lisa, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Lisa Marganelli has been our guest here on the program. Her book is Oil on the Brain: Adventures from the Pump to the Pipeline.